people want to help the kids. People want to do things to make changes in this world. It's just that no one knows this is even going on.
Welcome back to season 3 of Intrinsically Motivated, where we have conversations with experts in the field of addiction, recovery, and those personally affected by it, as we seek to mobilize the church to replace addiction and mental health challenges with flourishing. On today's episode, we'll be sitting down with Generation O. Generation O is an organization that cares for and supports those affected by prenatal opioid and substance exposure. I'm Tucker Clements, audio engineer and editor for Uplift Appalachia, and this is Intrinsically Motivated. I know you all have already been talking together for quite some time. So how did you all first make a connection? So that would probably be a great place to start.
You are going to be so surprised.
I'm ready.
Will Barber.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Which is funny. He just keeps coming back around into our lives.
We interact with Will Barber in so many different areas.
Yes, but he reconnected Amy and me. And who was it that connected us like a year or two ago?
It was a woman from the, what is the organization? It's slipping my mind. Action. They sort of bring organizations together in partnership in East Tennessee.
Strong ACC?
Strong ACC.
The Strong ACC. Yes. Okay. Right. And I'm on the leadership council there. And somebody had said, oh, you need to talk to her. We emailed once, I think. Yeah. And then it just evaporated. And then Will met her and said, you've got to talk to Amy.
Yes. Yes. And it seemed, so there were multiple independent sources that were concluding that we needed to get together, collaborate.
And weren't they right? They were so right.
Yeah.
So why is it so worthwhile that we collaborate? I need to know what it is that you guys are doing and so that we can connect it with what we're doing.
Right.
Because I have personally heard a little bit about what you're doing. But what is Generation O? What is Generation O's mission?
Lynette, you take this. She's our fearless leader.
So Generation O is the national organization for opioid exposed children. And we are, our mission is to help all of the children that are born opioid exposed and their families. We are seeing Amy and I as parents of opioid exposed children and the over 7,000 other caregivers that we chat with daily on our Facebook forum. We are all seeing long-term challenges with these kids. Everyone is focused on what happens at birth, the withdrawal, the neonatal abstinence syndrome. But what we are focused on is what happens after hospital discharge and what happens for the rest of their lives. And so we came together, Amy and I found each other in this group, and we joined up with a couple of other moms from different places in the country also raising these children. And we created this organization because this generation of children, Generation O, we're not hearing about them. We're not talking about them. Society doesn't know they exist. We're not helping them. And not only are they suffering, but their families are suffering. And there's many of them. I seen a statistic that by age 9, 50% of them are no longer living with their biological mom. So we're talking adoptive parents, foster parents, kinship caregivers, grandparents, all of those people that are in these children's lives searching for how to help them. And so we came together to figure it out ourselves at the same time that we're sharing the information that we have. And we just envision a world where these kids are known about and they're helped just like any other child with any other challenges.
Yeah, I know. I hear you saying it's a group of people that aren't known. And that, like, I know neonatal abstinence syndrome is one of the kind of statistics that we use when we meet with churches all the time, and they're usually looking for information on either trauma, adversity, or addiction. Because a lot of times when we're talking about addiction and recovery with churches, one of their limitations is we're too scared to start because we don't understand what's going on, or we don't know how things work, or anything like that. And so a lot of times it's opening people's eyes to the reality of the situation that we find ourselves in, And I know neonatal abstinence syndrome is one of the statistics that we often share that really opens people's eyes to just how prevalent, you know, the problems are that we're seeing. I know my stat, you might have more updated stats. One of the stats that we've been using is that 10% of the babies in our area are born with neonatal abstinence syndrome. And that may be higher. I don't know what that actually might be statistically speaking, but to, it's not, and like you said, it doesn't just stop with the situation they find themselves in when they're born, but then they're going to have long lasting, you know, things they have to deal with along the way. And it really is eye-opening and kind of shocking for people to hear. I know you were, you said you kind of found yourself in a group of people who were working through similar situations. Do people realize just how many people are sharing their experiences that are out there? Or are you trying to get the word out that there are people who are working together and trying to kind of band together out there? Or do people in that situation tend to find community that way early on?
I would say all of those things are true. We are searching for each other, whether we know it or not, because it's a very isolating path to be raising a child that has struggles every day, and there's not a guidebook. I mean, if your child has autism, you can search online, you can buy a book, you can talk to a autism coach, you can find out all the things to do to help your child. And the numbers of these children are 3 times higher than the number of children born with Down syndrome. And we know Down syndrome, we know what that looks like, we know there's supports for that population. Our population is 3 times larger, and we're not. I mean, we have come into play so that we can start this conversation. And I'll give you a new statistic, Tanner. The 10% that you're using, you can probably double that to 20% because of all the babies that go through NAS and get that diagnosis in the hospital. There's double the amount that are actually exposed to opioids during the pregnancy. And either they don't go through the withdrawal, or the withdrawal is so mild that they don't get the diagnosis. There's a lot of reasons why they don't get the diagnosis, but recent science has shown that it's almost double. And so we estimate there's over 500,000 of these children that have been born since the opioid epidemic started. There's two in my house. One is 15 and one is 5. And so, you know, they're getting older. You know, we know school systems are struggling with them. I mean, I'm sure you've heard the stories about how, like, in there was a study or a story on in a West Virginia kindergarten about how the kindergartners are just so hard to handle. And we know West Virginia is an area that has one of these, the highest rates of this. And so we need to find each other as parents, because we need answers and we need to band together to have our voices heard. And I mean, I'm sure Amy will feel the same way, but like just meeting Amy and just meeting some of the other people in this group, these are my closest friends now. You know, they live in San Antonio, in Minneapolis, in all parts of the country, but we're all doing this alone, but now we're together through the organization and through our support group.
And Amy, tell me a little bit, what does that look like? Because you work specifically in Tennessee, you're here in Tennessee, correct?
Correct.
Is that right?
Yes.
So what does that look like for us? Because we're obviously, a lot of the people that we know and we're working with are here in Tennessee. So what does that look like specifically for us here in Tennessee?
Well, it's very similar, only on a more local level. I originally had linked up and became in community with some parents raising these children in East Tennessee. It was a informal Facebook group. And just like with the national group, you know, people come to these groups every day. There's new people joining, and they're coming because there is no other source of information and support and resources. So we have to look to each other. And so when we started the national organization, also started an office here in East Tennessee, and working to provide resources, more support, and just kind of get in there and help the families that are struggling and support the kids. We've got offices starting in other states, other cities as well. So
that's great. So one of the things I want to ask you, and so I know we've been talking about some of the research, which I know we will get into some of the research that we want to happen or that is happening. Do you also do like lobbying I know there's when you're a nonprofit, there are limits on lobbying, but do you do, shall we say, legislator education?
Yes. That's something I'm really interested in doing, and have been talking to some legislators and speaking to the Opioid Abatement Council. I'm treading a little bit lightly, trying to figure out the extent that how much I can do as a 501c3 status.
Right.
So we're kind of working through the legal end as far as how much we can go that way. But to give you a little bit more about Tennessee. So beginning in 2006, I started working in the juvenile courts in Knoxville, Anderson, Roane, Union, a lot of the counties surrounding Knoxville. And I worked as a guardian ad litem, which is an attorney for children who are caught up in the court system, caught up in the foster care system, or for one reason or another. And I also, at the same time, I also represented parents who were in a crisis of facing losing custody or their parental rights of their children. As you can imagine, substance use disorder was pretty much the reason for all of these, a lot of those crises the families were facing. And the number of children and families coming through these courts in Tennessee since 2006. I mean, it's staggering, really. I've represented hundreds and hundreds, and there were a lot of babies, a lot of babies born. I think that there was one time, one court, I won't mention it, but was so, dare I say, overwhelmed by the number of babies and children coming into the system, they set up a surrender day to sort of expedite the process of processing the kids through the system and getting them into, safe homes and what have you. So that was my first exposure to the impact of the opioid epidemic in this community, representing these children, and then would follow them through, continue to represent them if they went into foster care for however long they stayed in foster care. So I can't give you, specific statistics here in this region. It's hard because of confidentiality, but it's staggering. I thought it was. So
Right. Well, and that's one of the things in Tennessee. When I first got in this area, it was probably 2008, I started working with somebody at our med school to study. We actually were studying, it was a nicotine grant to get women to stop smoking, but we were also measuring all kinds of things, and we were measuring drug exposure and so forth. And then they were doing a great job of measure. We were like one of the first states to measure NAS and to track it and to have a system. And that went on for a decade or more, probably. And now they don't report it that way. It's just kind of like, we just don't count that, which is like, you know, if you don't know, it goes away, I guess. I don't know. But it's like, it's, you can't find it. It used to come out on the Children's Health Report every year. We would get by month how many were NIS. We'd get what drug exposed they were exposed to, mostly buprenorphine, as you know. And that just doesn't, it's not reported that way anymore. So
yeah,
that's, I think that if we're able to, if Generation O, the organization, is able to amplify the voices of these families and what we're seeing, that the policy piece will be that much easier, you know, because people, you know, people want to help the kids. People want to do things to make changes in this world. It's just that no one knows this is even going on. You know, we're so far under the radar that even the buprenorphine piece, which I'm sure we could go anywhere with that. But, you know, when we are able to show the long-term effects of all opioid exposure, including buprenorphine, that's going to shine a bright light on what needs to be done with policy. I mean, I almost feel like I'm interested in policy and legislation, and I'm interested in science, and I'm interested in helping the kids, and I'm interested in helping the parents, you know? And so, like, I would love to go in every direction, but if I have to choose, I'm going to put the policy and legislation a little bit off to the side and just show everyone what's going on, you know? And then I think that the people who are prescribing the buprenorphine, they may realize that, oh, we had no idea this was going on. And then they may decide that they want to make changes.
And I think I love what you said, like, you'd rather set that stuff aside and prioritize the knowledge, because the knowledge is going to lead to more action from more people trying to just be more involved in helping and serving and these sorts of things. And I think that that's one of the things that we struggle with a lot of times, because we find ourselves, you know, we set out, let's mobilize the church to address addiction. And we want to see the people that are in recovery or still in active addiction being helped. And a lot of times we do find ourselves busied with the work of not lobbying, because we don't lobby, but informing people in government, or, you know, writing articles about different research and science. And all of that we think is important. But a lot of times we sit down and say, but are we actually doing the thing that we actually set out to do, which is helping people? And it's such a hard thing to balance, and it sounds like you're at least aware that that balance is a thing that you're having to struggle with, and I think that's really, it's helpful for me to hear just from an organizational standpoint, like, we're not the only ones that are trying to balance all these, because they all need to happen.
Right, it's like, I think we now know, we know things that could happen to prevent it. They're not happening yet, we want people to prevent it, but the kids that are already here. And they need the help. And so you don't want to say, well, those are write-offs, let's just make some healthy ones. No, that's not what, you know. And it's like when somebody's addicted, it's like, well, we want to prevent addiction. Yes, we do. But this person is still living with the results of that right now. And so they also need the support. And so that's it's like all of it, and which is one of the reasons that we very much focus on getting lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of people equipped and knowledgeable, because nobody can do it all. You know?
So. Well, it's like you said, you know, you found a community of people that understood, and that's allowed you to kind of amplify your impact because you have people around you. And that's kind of the same point that we want to see for us within the church. We want to see that happening, because the more people that can be involved, the more effective we're going to be as we kind of, you know, step in to serve people and that sort of thing. But I know you keep talking a lot about knowledge and awareness and these sorts of things. What are the things that maybe people who don't realize just how prevalent this is in our country, or in the world, but specifically in our area or in our, you know, communities, what are the things that they've probably already seen that they don't recognize is a result of this whole generation growing up with opioid exposure?
Yeah, like you mentioned the school. Yeah. What kinds of things are people seeing? Because that, yeah, just
yeah. I mean, the things they're struggling with, you know, the types of academic difficulties they have and the types of behavioral challenges they have in school are not unique to opioid exposure. And so when you see a child who's struggling like this, I don't think it's really possible to say, oh, this child was opioid exposed, whereas this child is acting that way because of trauma, whereas this child is acting that way because of a different thing going on in their household. But just the fact that there's so many more of these kids, and opioid exposure is contributing to much of it, along with opioid exposure is the trauma. You can't separate them because the opioid exposure and the trauma both happen in the womb. And then if you have withdrawal that's considered neonatal abstinence syndrome or neonatal opioid withdrawal syndrome, that's a horrible first life experience. That's another trauma. And then depending on who you go home with, if you go home with a parent other than the biological mom, there's another trauma because you're being separated from all that you've known. If you go home into a family that's still dealing with the throes of substance abuse, poverty, violence, all the things that go along in that world, that's not healthy for the child either. So some people get really concerned about trying to figure out, you know, which piece is connected exactly to the opioids. And there's enough evidence to show that opioids cause specific vision problems, specific sleep disorders, specific feeding challenges. Like, these are all things that are tied specifically to the opioids.
I can jump in and expand on that. You know, one thing that really struck me in participating in these groups, whether with East Tennessee and nationally, is the testimonies of the caregivers are very powerful and moving. Just to give you a couple of anonymous examples, you know, a mother says she's got four opioid or drug exposed children that she's raising. One was in the NIC unit for 60 days, nearly died during the withdrawal process. That child is now 2.5, is nonverbal, cognitively delayed, developmentally delayed, gross motor delayed, fine motor delayed, and has a genetic syndrome. The second was in the NICU for 38 days with terrible withdrawals, is now a year old and globally delayed. A third was only in the NICU for 8 days withdrawing, but is now 3.5, is very aggressive, impulsive, rage-based behaviors, and they're seeing a team of behavioral and psychiatric specialists. The fourth was withdrawing in the NIC unit for 47 days. His withdrawals were severe. He suffered acute kidney injuries as well as a cardiac event during the withdrawal process. He's now 10 weeks old and is at home and still struggling quite a bit. So, you know, hearing the testimonies, and there are hundreds and hundreds, you know, we've got over 7,000 in our group. And what's fascinating, well, I mean, I don't know, fascinating, it's tragic, is that there are, you know, everyone, these stories are just too similar to not have a common denominator. You know, and here in East Tennessee, I know there's a number of caretakers, a number of families that are raising, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 of these children. And it's very taxing. It's difficult for these families, particularly because they weren't prepared. I think that a lot, and Lynette, she would probably agree, I think that a lot of these caretakers, these parents, whether they're biological parents or caretakers, child is sent home from the hospital after the withdrawal. Doctors say, congratulations, you have a perfectly healthy baby. don't ever mention this again. Let's pretend this never happened. You know, and go raise your child without stigma. You've got a perfectly healthy baby. Well, that's couldn't be further from the truth. And the problem with that is that the parents are therefore completely unprepared when the aggressive, impulsive rage behaviors, the cognitive delays, the constellation of symptoms, they're not prepared, and they're scrambling to get treatment, scrambling to find, well, what treatment do I get? What, pediatricians aren't prepared. And it's really, it's unfortunate this many decades into the opioid epidemic that we're so unprepared, and that and I think that a lot of us parents raising these kids, it would have been helpful had we been more prepared, and I think the children, my child maybe wouldn't have suffered quite so much if I was ready for this and had access to information and resources. So in
talking to other people in your community who are probably facing that same kind of, hey, everything's fine, don't need to worry about it now, there aren't going to be any long-term effects from this, you've gotten through the worst of it, everything's going to be great. Why do you think that culture has developed to not talk about it, or to assume there won't be kind of, longer lasting effects of this?
Well, I have a couple of theories. It may be a little controversial. I mean, I think there
is... We're fine with controversy. That's okay.
Well, this is the place.
there is some stigma, right? I mean, Lynette, remember there was the crack baby, era. So we've got to fight some stigma to a certain extent. And that I think that is particularly difficult for biological moms with substance use disorder who, there's even perhaps more fear of stigma attached with them raising their children. I think that, and this is just speculation, but I think that the Department of Children's Services, which is the probably the largest organization, at least here in Tennessee, that is having the children adopted, might have an interest in downplaying the challenges. They have hard enough time, getting foster families and adoptive families. I don't know, but I could take a guess that they probably have an interest in playing these things down. I think that the, drug manufacturers could have an interest in not having long-term effects be acknowledged or out there, I think that they might have an interest in naysaying, ugh, that's just foolishness. There's no long-term effects. So
we also have a problem with the initial science that came out. So these kids were studied, when 10 years ago, 15 years ago, there was an interest in what happens to these kids after they leave the hospital. And at age 2, which is all the studies, let's check them out for the first 2 years of life. Let's see how they're doing. And at age 2, there are not a lot of differences between an opioid exposed child and a non-opioid exposed child. So seeing that, I think the public felt comfortable with that really is all it is. You go through with a withdrawal and then you're okay, because at age 2, you're okay. And even in our group, we have people that come in all the time. We get 150 new members a month. And they'll come in and they'll be in the throes of the withdrawal, because the withdrawal can last up to 6 months. So even when you leave the hospital, there are still issues going on with the child. And so, you know, they'll be connecting and, you know, I don't know what to do. This is really hard. And then after that part settles down, they're like, my baby is doing so great. And, you know, I really don't think any of this stuff is going to apply to my child. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, okay, I'll see you when they turn 3 or 4. And so many of them come back at age 3 or 4 when that normal stage of saying no and having tantrums and the normal developmental things for a 3 and 4 year old happen on steroids. Their tantrums are longer, they're more intense, they're more aggressive, and, you know, there's just a whole different piece that you're seeing in an opioid-exposed child. And so when we're able to show, okay, let's study the kids when they're 3 and 4. Let's study the kids when they get into school. My oldest, I got the same information that Amy explained, you know, take them home, raise them up as a normal child. There's nothing to see here. And I did that. And I had 2 other kids at home at the time. And these 3 kids were close in age. And, you know, we did all the normal family stuff. And my son with the opioid exposure fit right in. There wasn't anything unusual about him until he got into school. And that's when we started noticing that this brilliant kid, because let me just take a sideline to mention, these children, the opioids are affecting them in what you could say are positive ways too. There are some brilliant, brilliant kids in our group. Unfortunately, they test like they have cognitive delays because of all the challenges they have in learning, but that doesn't mean they're not brilliant. They have, a lot of them, this magnetism that, you know, you see a child where everyone wants to be around that child. A lot of these kids are like that. But anyways, going back to my point, this was my child. And so when he got into school and he couldn't spell, I'm like, well, this isn't right. This kid is very verbal. He's smart. He's talking as with peers that are much older than him. Why can't he spell? And that's when we found out these vision processing issues he was having. So science will one day show us that there are long-term effects, but initially, and most of what is out there today, is they're fine because they're fine at 2.
I think one of the things that a lot of the science that we get involved in is tending to say, we already know the answers to this science. It's just, how long is it going to take science to catch up to what we're already seeing? That sort of thing. It sounds kind of like that's where you are too, in that we know it's true a lot of times because we're studying things that the Bible says is true from our perspective. It's like, if the Bible says it's true, we believe it's going to be right. We just got to test it. But there is this kind of reticence to study it because, and I think you already more than alluded to it, but I think there is kind of a culture that says, we don't want to stigmatize these kids by putting labels on them. And that's true. We don't want to stigmatize them in the sense that we don't want them to be treated lesser than because they have these challenges. But at the same time, we also need to acknowledge that there are going to be challenges that they're facing so that we can do everything we can in our power to kind of help serve and support them through those different challenges that they're going to be facing. But at the same time, we also don't want to stigmatize the current, you know, standard of treatment, what the evidence already says, what the science already says. It's closed. We've already studied it. It's safe. Because once we start to challenge those things, then a whole industry
unravels.
And that's a problem for people with other interests as well. And so we're acknowledging the same things you're acknowledging from slightly different places, but we're kind of seeing the same things playing out. I mean, we have one article that we've been, it's under review right now.
Again. they read it. I sent it to
them. Yeah, but it's been rejected however many,
five times
or something, because we're not interested in studying that science has already been done and it's closed. The case is closed. And I think it's going to take people who are willing to, you know, like you said, kind of shine the light on the reality of the actual situation from people that are actually living the life,
right?
You know, not just the politicians, or not just the scientists, or not just, you know, the companies that are manufacturing the you know, quote unquote, life-saving drugs, these sorts of things. But it's going to take, you know, actual people, you know, kind of banding together and saying there's more that we should be doing. We're not doing enough. And I think the fear is, oh, you're going to put this label on me, or you're going to put this label on somebody, and that's going to make it worse. Well, there's going to be some that is worse, but we're also just acknowledging a reality, but that might also help us to make longer term, more helpful impact along the way.
Right. I think sometimes the stigma word is used sort of as a weapon to get people to submit to a certain way. You know, it's like one of the things we're doing with the folks in Scotland, it's like they don't want to stigmatize anyone by arresting them or making them stop using medication or making them stop using illicit drugs. So if we use the medications, then we're not whatever. And it's like this, it's like using that term, but then it takes away any agency that you have to change your own behavior, you know, or to acknowledge that somebody's behavior might need to change, you know, and that's the tension.
We sometimes apply stigma in the wrong places.
Right,
it's like
right.
It's like there is some stigma around. There are things that we should not do, and there are things that are maybe there are things that are harmful to us when we do them. But we don't want the stigma to transfer to the value of the person who finds themselves in that situation. I think the fear is because we're going to put this label on somebody, that's going to make them less valuable, and that's not the case.
Not at all. That's not
what we're trying to say. But what we're trying to say is we want to still apply whatever. Label sounds bad, but apply whatever, you know, the situation is to someone so that we can actually give them the support that they actually need.
Right.
And I think that's, exactly. It sounds like that's kind of where you guys are as well. It's like, we want to say this is a thing and it's real. And we have, you said 7,000 people in your group or however many that are facing the situation, but they can't get the support if no one will acknowledge that there is an issue that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, that's an awful lot of people to just be delusional about what's going on. It sounds it sounds like once you begin to have that many people, and even the fact that you and we are coming to the same place from completely different directions is a pretty confirmatory. But I think the voices of the people in those households, and this is I'll speak to the research piece for a minute because we have started talking about doing some research to try to get this out there. It's been a very hard group of kids to study because you mentioned the guardian ad litem. The when you don't have like kids in care and foster care or whatever, when you don't have a legal person who can consent for you to be in research as a child, you don't get studied. And we've run into that even for other, I mean, just doing a survey in a school, you know, you can't include the kids in foster care because there's nobody who can sign consent for them to be in research, you know? And so it gets really dicey to try to find out in a controlled real research study what's going on because you don't have access. The legal ramifications prevent that, you know? And so hearing from guardians and caregivers and grandparents or whoever, that's kind of been the workaround. It's like, well, I know of this child, but whatever, as opposed to the child being actually in the study. But then people say, oh, well, that's not real science. Yeah, well, fine. Our hands are tied.
So. But, you know, kind of like your earlier guest, Dr. Olson, who said, you know, he used the analogy of, you know, he has a pregnant patient and she is on epilepsy medication, and you know it's perfectly okay to advise her of the risks of her taking the epilepsy medication, and you know I don't know why it's harder to get that kind of caution with opioids for the parents, for the pregnant mom.
To be able to choose not to.
Wait a minute. We don't have enough studies on the effect of epilepsy medication. No reason to warn anybody about taking that or ibuprofen for that matter.
Nobody's
saying, there's no real science on that. So.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I haven't looked at. I don't know about other states' buprenorphine prescribing guidelines, but I know ours in our state. And I know when I first started doing this, working in this area, I read them back in, it was probably 2018 or something like that, 2019, and realized that some of the authors of our guidelines for just general buprenorphine guidelines, but also for pregnant women, were written by lobbyists for pharmaceutical companies. And I thought, this is not right. This is, there's a problem here.
There's a conflict of interest.
There's a little conflict of interest here. And so now I've checked more recent ones and they were edited and those people were not on it. But even with the obstetrics, ACOG, the Organization for Obstetricians, it still says there are no ill effects of buprenorphine. It's like, there are no lasting effects. I mean, it says it like there are none. And it's not like, you know, the thing is, you could say there aren't any known effects or something like that, but it's like there are no effects, go ahead. You know, it's like the benefits outweigh the risks, which they have as, you know, someone might overdose while they're pregnant. And it's like, well, they might anyway. But it's like, what about the baby? But then when you say, what about the baby during pregnancy, that opens the other whole can of worms about baby, fetus, tissue, you know, all of that too. And so it's not just the pharmaceutical company that gets unraveled. It's the mom versus baby and pregnancy and all of that. It just all is entangled.
We like to encourage the prescriber who's writing a prescription for a pregnant mom for buprenorphine to write two prescriptions, one for mom, one for baby. And the prescription for baby is early intervention.
Oh.
That's what
I... It's in the ether out there. It's just an idea, like, but, you know...
Or even if you write the buprenorphine for the mom and the buprenorphine for the baby. It's like, acknowledge that both of them are receiving the drug.
That's our message. Well, that's our message that they're going to, you know, the mom is probably going to continue on the buprenorphine forever. And they're going to treat the baby until the baby is discharged from the hospital. And that's it. The baby doesn't get continued treatment. And the child will need, particularly when it turns three or four and for the lifetime, well, ask TennCare. You know, because that's, you know, I've kind of wondered why, I wondered if TennCare and or in other states, you know, the Medicaid and stuff might want to weigh in here because, you know, currently TennCare is footing a pretty big bill treating these children. You know, my child is in therapy over the summer, 30 hours a week, I think, you know, billing. And I've heard that some of these therapies, $1,000 a day, you know. So I'm kind of like, when is TennCare going to wake up and weigh in on this? And that's kind of, you know, something that I looked at the opioid settlement money as an opportunity. You know, I hate to sound like I focus on this money, but it really is an opportunity to actually something that's not taxpayer dollars, you know, to treat these children. Mm-hmm. But the children, the Generation O is a shadow generation, just not accepted, really.
Well, and the sad thing is that it seems like people would be more interested in listening to an economic argument about mm-hmm. why we need to change the things that we're doing so that we can save taxpayer dollars. I completely agree with
you.
I think we've been trying to pull together some research about, you know, just the economic impact of treating opioid use disorder and that sort of thing. And it's like, you can get people who are, you know, we need to save more money. We need to not spend as much. We need to, you know, balance budgets and all that to hear, oh, it'll save me money. I can make more money personally, or I can keep more of my money if we treat addiction. Sure, let's do that. You hate for that to be the thing that motivates people and not the individual people that need to be helped.
Right.
So it's sad that that's the way that we can get people to acknowledge it, but it is a really, I think, valuable piece of the conversation to have, right, in that we are spending so much money treating problems that we're still creating ourselves, in a sense, because of the way that we're responding to, you know, just one symptom of a greater issue that we're, right, dealing with.
Of course, we talk the economics of everything related to addiction, from foster care to prison, all of it. There are so many economic factors there, but we're also interested in, I don't know if we talked about the NET device or not. I think we had talked about it, but I can't remember if it was in the movie or somewhere else, but they were talking to the people in this town in Kentucky, and they were saying, don't you want these people to be free of their drugs? And they said, look around you. Our entire economy is recovery. If they're cured, we don't exist. Wow. It's like, oh, whoa, gosh. That's it's so sad, but it's life.
It's the reality that we're facing. And those people have families that they're trying to, so it's like, right, you can understand,
right,
why somebody is so focused on themselves, their economic situation.
Right.
That being said, it doesn't excuse the fact that we're still, in some cases, taking advantage of, in some cases, like you said, there's a shadow generation, right, sweeping certain things under the rug so that we can just kind of maintain some sort of a status quo, right, or at least just not have to look at the thing that we think is going to make us uncomfortable that's right in front of us.
Right.
Well, as we go.
We can definitely help those profitable recovery homes if we continue to ignore Generation O, because that's exactly where they're headed.
You know? It is where they're headed. The number of kids, you know, people say, oh, well, it's just what they learned. Well, not if they were adopted from the NICU. It's not that they went into another drug exposing home. It's that they're predisposed through either the addiction, the genetics, the trauma, whatever it is, they are going to be that next generation of participants. You know,
and we talk a lot about breaking that cycle, and that's right, really, really, right, hard to do, because we're however many generations kind of into this cycle now. It's going to take that same number, probably more number of generations, to get us back out. But we have to start making strides now, or we're never going to get somewhere with it.
Right.
If we don't taper the buprenorphine practice, then it's just going to continue. NAS is going to continue to rise, which the latest surveillance report from Tennessee, it's a couple of years old, but it's the latest one they have of their statistics. I mean, it's increasing slightly in Tennessee, mm-hmm, currently, and they attribute it to the uptick in the use of the medication-assisted treatment. They have the, right, statistics, mm-hmm, and the charts and the graphs, and they say most of the babies withdrawing in the hospital are withdrawing from the buprenorphine, right, and it's ticked up, and it's going up, not down. And the state even acknowledges it's because of the increasing use of the mat. So, yeah, you know, if you talked about, you know, if we're ever going to, you know, resolve or reduce the problem. Well, as far as NAS, it we're on a trajectory up, going up.
So I want to make a little transition, just because one of the things that I think about, because you said this all started with just people in similar situations finding each other, mm-hmm, and then kind of walking through life together and supporting one another as they were going through that. And we do a lot of training on trauma-informed care. And one of the key principles that we talk about when how to be trauma-informed is providing a place where people can find peer support, people that have either are going through the exact same thing you're going through right now, or have gone through it before, come out the other side, and now have insight to kind of give back and walk along with you as you go through it. That seems to be the community that you all have built. Have you seen being some of the real benefits of that? Because it sounds like just having those people in your life that you can look at and know exactly what each other's situation. Like you alluded to it earlier. I hear you being really confident right now. Come talk to me in a couple of years, because I know what your situation's going to be. And I think that level of confidence, but also that level of patience to wait for somebody to know what the situation is going to be. What kind of benefits have you all found just having that community and being able to support one another in that way?
It's interesting because as the parent of both a 15-year-old and a 5-year-old, I almost feel like I'm the expert going back through it a second time with new eyes. Science had evolved in the 10 years between my sons, and so had I. And so I'm able to practice differently with my younger son, and he's on a different trajectory because of it, because my parenting is different now. And the resources that were available to him were different than with my first son. And I think that within our community, a lot of it is just the education and the awareness. You know, if your child is struggling with something, and we hear about all the time that people will, you know, they go to their pediatrician. That's usually their first line of, how do I help my child? And many of the things that these kids present with are subtle, at least to start. And so it's very easy for a pediatrician who's never was educated about long-term effects of prenatal opioid exposure to just, you know, look at that semi-subtle symptom and say, they'll grow out of it. You know, let's just wait and watch it for a little while. And if you as a parent have been educated that, okay, these kids have a lot of feeding challenges. And so when your child starts to have a feeding challenge and your pediatrician is either not helpful or is ignoring it, you can come to this community and you can hear from all the other moms about what worked for their child. And so you get the tools that you need and you get the confidence to be a better parent, because now you are able to do things for your child that prior to that you couldn't do. You were just helpless.
So I'm curious, you say, and I love replicating. I always say I have two older children, two younger children. It's my replication experiment. Because there's nine years between the two sets.
And just to be fair,
yes,
those two sets had completely different parents.
They did have completely different parents because
yes, you're very different people with them.
But look how well you're doing.
Look how well I'm doing.
Look how well you're doing. but I'm interested, could you just give us an example of, and you can do it theoretically, not to out your children, but maybe a way you approached things with your 15-year-old that now you approach differently with your 5-year-old?
I've got a perfect example. So both of my boys are all boy, you know, the type of rough and tumble, sports-minded boys. And when my older child was 5, 6, 7 years old, he's hyperactive, he's anxious, he needs to move constantly. And so one of the things he does is bounce a ball. We have tile floors in our house, and that bouncing ball makes a lot of noise. Some days I could handle it, other days I couldn't. And on the days I couldn't handle it, I went off on him. Stop bouncing that ball. How many times have I told you about bouncing that ball? So then I learned that these kids have slow processing. And so when I say to him, stop bouncing the ball, between the time it takes that message to get to his brain, register, and then have his mind tell his body to stop bouncing the ball, there could be 3 more bounces before that stops. I can't tolerate 3 more bounces. I need him to stop immediately. And so, you know, so much tension between my older son and I for things that he had no control over. He was going to stop, but he just needed to get those 3 bounces in because he was still processing the message. Now, with my younger guy, when he's bouncing the ball, I tell him to stop, and then I wait, and I give him time. And I might even give him a full 30 seconds, you know? I have different expectations, and the expectations have changed because I've learned what's going on in the minds of these kids and what they have control over and what they don't.
And I think one of the things that you said was, because by knowing what's going on, not just the behavior, but what's going on inside. This is goes back to exactly one of the examples that we, one of the metaphors that we use all the time, which is this iceberg. It's like you see the behavior up here, but there's a lot of stuff going on underneath the water that you can't see. It's like just by knowing that that's the case, that completely changes the way you respond to somebody, is why it's so important for not just parents, but for sure parents, but school teachers, educators,
pediatricians,
churches,
absolutely,
entire communities.
Yes,
to understand that, not to say so we need to accept the behavior, but rather to say we need to be patient as people are processing and learning how to change those behaviors, or you know, move on to the next thing, or provide some sort of way to redirect or whatever it may be. It's why it's so important that so many people need to know these things so that we can respond better in a way that's going to be more helpful to people. Yeah.
It looks like deliberate, I'm not listening to you. Like, yeah, I'll stop, but let me do it a couple more times just to aggravate you, just to turn that knife in a little bit. That's what it looks like. And my husband, you know, it took him a little bit longer to understand all of this with our older son. And, you know, he's manipulating us. Why are we allowing this to happen? And, you know, the poor child is getting punished for something he has no control over. If he was at school, he may get a detention, you know, and you said it. It's just, there's every part of this child's life, anyone who interacts with him, needs to understand what's going on.
Right. Right. It'd be nice if they came with labels. We did a training. So the church where Tanner goes, they have a lot of foster kids, a lot of fostering families. And we finally got to do a training 2 weeks ago, a week and a half ago, for their children's workers. We want to do it with the whole church, but with the children's workers going through some of this, like trauma and addiction and so forth, to help them to, again, understand there's stuff going on, you know, and we don't know what all it is, but here are some behaviors you might see, here's some and other ways to respond. And that is the kind of thing that we would love to be able to do everywhere with everyone. And then it's helpful because, again, the things they can't control, or there might be things they can, and you learn it, and you can compare notes. And even the people that were at the training began comparing notes. We never knew who the child, well, you might have known who the child was. I didn't, because I don't go to church there. But it's like, oh, we've seen this in this child, and this is what happened, and this is the way we responded, and this really helped her. And, you know, it's like just having that ability to troubleshoot, problem solve, which I know you do in your Facebook group. Those kinds of things are so helpful, not just for your own sanity, but for the child's development too.
Yeah, and again, it comes back to there may still be, like your example is bouncing a ball. There may be some behaviors that are much more dangerous that need to stop, and that's and it's going to become
strangling
more
the pets or, you know, whatever.
Whatever it may be. You want to, we're not trying to say, so we have to let certain things keep happening because of the situation that the kids find themselves in. It's not that we're trying to say that at all.
Right.
But we need to find more effective ways and more, I guess, caring ways to respond to these things, because that's going to lead to probably a better result long term, but also it's also going to help. It's going to help the person who is responsible for that child probably maintain a little bit more level head, a little bit more sanity as they're working. Be able to be a little more patient long term and not feel like the defeat that comes with, well, they're still not listening to me, or I'm doing something, you know. And I think it's going to help lead to more long-term, more sustainable efforts in trying to help these kids and trying to help anybody that's experienced these past traumas, adversity, whatever it may be.
And it reinforces this idea that interpersonal connection is what we keep coming back to, but it's the getting to know someone, spending time with someone, whoever it is, and not just like rush to judgment about their intent or whatever. And there's so much, the walking with whoever is so much what we're about. And we keep coming back to that same principle, no matter who the players are, And even, you know, and even the pediatricians, it's like, yes, we want them to be different, but they don't know what they don't know. And so it's like helping them to know. And the legislators don't know what they don't know. I think there are a lot of prescribers that they've been told, they've got the sheet that says, this is what's effective. People will question you, but go ahead because it's best. And they really think it's the right thing, but people don't know what they don't know. And so it's the information sharing, I think, is important.
Yeah.
Andy, do you know what, for my child, what the number one treatment, discipline, problem-solving tactic, the one thing that works with my child is personal connection. If somebody makes a personal connection with him, and has that, you know, a safe bond type thing, I mean, it's a game changer. Everything, you know, discipline, everything, behaviors, it's the one thing that works.
That's fascinating. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
And if you can help the next person to know that, that's even better.
Yes. So. Yeah.
And that kind of builds to, I guess, one kind of last question that I had for you all, because having you all have community with each other, you're saying personal connection with your kid is what really helps. Personal connection's really expensive from an energy standpoint. Having that kind of community and support and, you know, peer help within your organization and within your groups is really expensive. We're talking about churches literally wrapping themselves around people that are struggling with addiction and recovery and these sorts of things.
And foster care.
And foster kids and that sort of thing. And fostering a child is expensive. Not talking in a purely fiscal sense, but just like time, energy, brain power, emotional energy. That's really costly. And so one of the things that we always talk about is we can't do this in isolation, which is why that interpersonal connection, that community is so helpful to have around you as well. And you have to have a deep enough bench around you, because sometimes you are going to have to take a break. You are going to have to tap out. You are going to have to kind of recharge if you're going to stay in it. So I know that you all have community within your group, but do you all have, or do you encourage finding community and support outside of the people who are in the fight all the time, I guess is the way I want to ask that. Do you have people that can give you all a break here and there when you kind of need just a moment to kind of pause, you know, rest, and then kind of come back, re-engage, that sort of thing?
Working on that. Working on that. That sounds wonderful. That sounds great. Yeah, I mean, ideally, yes. Yeah.
I would say not enough, because over half of our group are adoptive parents, and, you know, there's a thing called respite care, and sometimes foster parents can get connected to that, but a lot of times adoptive parents, you know, once you sign those papers, you're on your own with your child. And the other thing that moms in our group tell us is that they can't find people who will spend time with their kid. I mean, Amy can tell us, you know, finding a preschool for these children can be impossible. So I think that while I completely realize the need for it, I have a very supportive husband. And when he's available, I run for the hills. but, you know, there's not... you know, we've raised these kids. I also have two girls that are exposed to other substances, not opioids. So they have different signature traits. And we've raised these kids for 18 years now. And many of our closest friends and family have never seen what we see in the home. You know, in the home where the kids feel safe to be who they authentically are, which could be ugly. That's not what they're showing their relatives at Thanksgiving. You know, that's not what they're showing our close family friends when we go on a camping trip together. So I think it's a really difficult thing for people in our shoes.
Amy, are you familiar with Tennessee Kids Belong? Do you know?
Yes. Thanks to an episode you had with, yes.
Aisha,
I am now. Yes. Yeah.
Good.
You are now my favorite advertiser for our podcast. Yeah, I don't know if you know this, but you're like, I listened to that episode.
Yeah, I'm sharing it left and right. Yeah.
That's wonderful.
That's great. Like, subscribe, all that, right? Isn't that what I'm supposed to? I'm not that kind of person.
It really is.
It's things that we're passionate about, and I think we are all passionate about similar things, so it makes sense that they would resonate with you. I do want you to advertise yourselves, too, though, and we'll put connections to whatever you want in the show notes, but I guess, for sure, the website, because I go to that and people can find resources there. But if it is parents that are looking for the Facebook group, I assume it's a closed Facebook group, how would they access that? How could they get invited to that?
Generation O.org is probably the easiest thing to remember, and you can get anywhere. We're offering, any supports through generationo.org. You can find your way to our Facebook group through there. It is a private Facebook group. So we ask a couple of questions of people, and as long as they answer the questions that, you know, they're there because they're raising a child like this, or maybe they're, you know, their sister's raising a child like this, you know, they're part of us and we welcome them in. Okay. We also have a Facebook page, which is public, that we're posting lots of good information. So maybe there's people who are interested in learning more about this community, but they're not raising a child like this. So our Facebook page, Generation O, would be a good resource. And we're on Instagram as well.
Okay.
That sounds great. And if anyone in East Tennessee wants to, you know, just communicate directly with me about, you know, local East Tennessee things, I'm at amy.brown@generationo.org. So
anybody
wants to reach out.
Yeah. So I think, what are some ways that, again, you talked about, you have lots of information publicly for people that maybe aren't specifically kind of working through this situation, but you also, when I asked that question, I saw you kind of say, it would be great to have lots of people that would be willing to kind of support us and be kind of, you know, that community supportive backup, you know, that's what we're trying to help develop at Uplift. We're trying to get the church to want to be those kinds of people. If churches that we've talked to or people who are listening to the podcast and have gotten motivated to get involved, are there ways that people can support the people in your community in some sort of meaningful way? And is there a way that they could get involved in supporting people in a meaningful way?
I think so. Amy mentioned that there are some new, I'm going to assume that the listeners are primarily in your local area. So Amy's going to be the very best resource. But for people outside of Tennessee, Amy mentioned that there are different, for instance, we're going to be opening Generation O Nevada. And there's a Generation O Southwest Florida coming on board. So, you know, in time, there will be other places that are doing local work. So if that is meeting people and providing respite care and doing things in person, our website will have tabs for each of the local offices. If it's something that's not as in person, on our website, there's volunteer opportunities. So, you know, you can go look for our, you know, join us, volunteer, and there's a whole list of things that people can do. October is the National Awareness Month for opioid-exposed children. And so we'll be running a whole campaign in October that's education-based about the kids. And we have a pearls and bow tie theme where we encourage people to wear a pearl necklace or a bow tie throughout the whole month just to start the conversation. I mean, I'm sure that any of us, if we started wearing pearls every day in a month, people are going to ask us why. And that gives us the opportunity to talk about Generation O and what these kids, who they are and what they need. And financial contributions are
always helpful for us as well. And so that's part of our fundraising campaign for Opioid Exposed Children Awareness Month next month.
Very good. So is there anything, obviously that's a big initiative for you. Is there anything that y'all are working on that you're excited about, or anything that you have coming up, or things that you're hoping to see happen?
We are about to kick off our Thrive Points pilot program, which we're very excited about. We're working with recovery nurseries. There's 5 recovery nurseries currently in the U.S., and we're working with one in West Virginia, Lily's Place. I don't know if you've heard of it. And then there's a couple in the Phoenix, Arizona area. But these are facilities that take the babies going through withdrawal straight from the NICU. And instead of having to go through their 2 weeks, 2 months of withdrawal in the NICU, they go into a home-like setting and mom can come in and they get to go through that together, medically supervised, but in a home-like setting instead of a hospital. And these recovery nurseries have amazing wraparound services. Some of them will be with the moms for 30 days, 60 days. There's one in Ohio that is able to be with the moms for the first 6 months of the baby's life. And however long they are able to keep the mom and baby together and, you know, just wrap them in love and all of the needs that they have, when they are discharged from that facility, this is when our Thrive Points pilot program is going to take off. So they're going to be transitioned over to us. And then virtually, we have a whole multimedia course online that they can take at their own, you know, timeline. It's little snippets. They can take it when they're available. And by signing up for it, they get some gifts that we give them in the beginning. And then when they complete the program, they get Thrive Points that they can spend in the Thrive Points store, where they can get developmental and age-appropriate toys and items that the mom and baby need. And so it's a reward for getting the education that we know these moms are going to benefit from. And so, we're excited about that because we've planned everything out. We've got our partners, and we're about to go live with it.
Excellent.
And any businesses really that want to help support that with, you know, we're open to that too.
Yeah. I'm going to have to look up those recovery homes. That's great.
I mean, I'm really excited that if so much of what you all are trying to do is raise awareness, I'm so glad that we get to have this conversation, because I understand better what your situation is. And now I want to do more that I can to get you more and more support, get you more people. So hopefully folks in the church, because that's who we interact with a lot, are hearing this. And like, this is one more way that we can be involved.
Churches can absolutely, there's, you know, the sky's the limit for the wraparound support that churches can give to our community. And I think Lynette even, you know, mentioned it could be something as simple as just helping with some childcare or give them a little respite. Mm-hmm. There's a mom in East Tennessee who reached out to our East Tennessee group. She says, I have a 2.5-year-old NAS son, and I'm a single mama now. I'm struggling a little, and I need a little break. I've looked into a Mother's Day Out program, but I'm not sure I can afford it. Is there anything out there that helps? I mean, this would be a great thing for, you know, a church group to wrap around this single mama who needs a break. Can't afford the Mother's Day Out kind of thing. So, you know, the sky's the limit. There's so many things if they want to get in touch with me.
So many ways.
In the group.
That's all. And I honestly believe that as people are hearing this, and now I have a lot more ways when people say, what are some ways I can get involved? I have one more new way that I can say, right. Well, here's a really easy way. Because a lot of times what we say is, what we're not asking you to do is necessarily easy, but it's a simple task. It's helping watch somebody's kid while they, you know, go get their
have
hair done.
Have a coffee, take a nap. Yeah.
Whatever it may be. And so I'm really excited that now I have new opportunities that I can kind of share with people as we're going.
Right.
Because any way that we can get somebody started working in this space, I think is going to lead to, you know, rapid replication. And that's what we really want to see happening.
Right.
So I'm really excited about what all you all are doing. I know we will continue to work together with you all in the future, because I just feel like our missions are so intertwined and the things that we're wanting to see happen are so, you know, we're moving in the same direction. So I'm sure this is the first of many conversations that we're going to have, but I'm really excited to kind of see where this goes next. So thank you all for talking to us. This was super amazing.
This has been a podcast powered by Uplift Appalachia. To learn more, you can find us at upliftappalachia.org or at Uplift Appalachia on Instagram.